Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and we are starting up a new season, and I'm really excited. I don't even know how many seasons I've been here now, but I know I'm on episode something, 130-something, so I wanted to just take a second and just say thank you to all the listeners, and thank you to everyone I've interviewed, and thank you to all the engineers and Heritage Radio for making this possible. I'm so excited and so honored to be able to bring you guys information about animals and methods and ways that we can help them, and other good stuff, just all animal. So, that being said, today I'm going to be speaking with Yulara Nagagawa, and Dr. Keith Lindsay, who have an organization called Elephants in Japan, and their story is pretty wild. I had absolutely no idea about it, and so I just wanted to get started. So, Yulara, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for contacting us. Are you kidding? This story is amazing. And I've been wanting to do a story on elephants for a long time, and I haven't been able to find the right venue and the right person. So, like, when you guys contacted us, I was so excited. So thank you.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you. Is Dr. Lindsay there?
I am as well. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm good. Yeah, very good. I'm talking to you from England, and it's nearly the middle of the night, but I'm still pretty good.
I know, and I wanted to say thank you for staying up late. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Pleasure.
So, if it's okay with you guys, I wanted just to jump in. Yulara, the first question is for you. Okay. I wanted to know if you could tell us about Elephants in Japan, and what exactly do you guys do?
So Elephants in Japan is an initiative that seeks to expose the plight of solitary captive elephants in zoos. And we are primarily focused on the solitary elephants in Japan currently. And that's because the impetus for the initiative was a solitary elephant named Hanako, who was a 69-year-old captive zoo elephant in a Tokyo zoo.
Wow.
And she caught the world's attention in early 2016, so last year.
Mm-hmm.
And nearly 500,000 people signed a petition to help her.
Wow.
And as things were actually looking to turn around for her, and her zoo had agreed to make some really important welfare changes to improve her life.
Nice.
She sadly passed away of old age.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, so that was in May of last year. So we decided that in her honor, so that other elephants did not have to face the same long, sad life she had, we would do this new initiative, which launched on World Elephant Day this year, August 12th.
Oh, that's cool. I'm just writing this down. I didn't know there was a World Elephant Day.
There is.
Definitely more important than, like, Bagel Day or Pizza Day, you know. It's nice to see they're being acknowledged.
Pizza Day is pretty important.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, too. So then you guys were really, you're really young then. You've only been around for about a year, huh?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. It's a, before Hanako, I'm not sure if there was much attention around elephants in zoos in Japan in particular. So this has all been a new push for sure.
That's very cool. And thank you for doing this. You know, it's this is one of these things that it's like so many people would sit back and go, you know, someone really needs to do something about this. And so thank you for doing it and being that person, because this is hard work.
Oh, it is my honor. I feel blessed that I have an opportunity to, you know, help shed even a little bit of light on the conditions of captive elephants, and especially the solitary ones that face enormous, you know, psychological and physical hardship because of the situations that they're put in.
You know, this is the thing, too, is because, like, I mean, I've been to Japan. I've been to the Tokyo airport. That's it. I was there for 6 hours. It was great. Like, I know nothing about the country at all. And I just made the assumption that, like, zoos in Japan, one, I assumed that they wouldn't have giant animals that weren't native to Japan. And second of all, I always just assumed that they would take, like, the highest care and really be conscious of, like, the needs that these animals need. So, like, when you guys first contacted us about this, I was blown away. And just shocked at the fact that, you know, these poor elephants are living in solitary and that sort of thing. So were you really surprised when you heard about this?
Yeah, well, I'm actually Japanese. So I was born and raised in Canada, but my parents are from Japan. So I have spent a lot of time over there. And I, in fact, lived in Tokyo between 2007 and 2012.
Oh, cool.
And that's when I was just walking down the street and I first saw this initial elephant, Hanako. And so, you know, I too was surprised. And I think, you know, that's been a really common reaction amongst people that hear about this campaign, is that they're like, what? Japan has elephants? Because it's such a small nation in their minds, like you just said. And
yeah.
So to think that they have so many, you know, this large a mammal, and actually it's something close to 100 total captive elephants in the country.
Wow.
Of which I believe 16, 17 are solitary. So, yeah, so there's a lot. And absolutely, I mean, in terms of the conditions of them, and I know Dr. Lindsay will be able to speak to this as well, it's not worse than any other country.
Okay.
But there are some zoos that certainly are a little bit behind in terms of the general, you know, kind of minimum standards.
Right,
of
right.
What would be appropriate to keep, you know, these elephants in. And so yeah, it is an unusual thing because I love Japan. I am Japanese, you know.
Yeah.
It's an innovative culture that brought cameras and cars to
totally.
The world. And so you wonder, and they're such compassionate, empathetic people. So there's a bit of a disconnect, and that's the gap we're trying to bridge.
And in all fairness to Japan, I mean, there are zoos in this country that are way behind as well. You know what I mean? I don't want this to be like, Japan sucks, because this is happening all over the world. So I don't want to make it like, you know, Japan's the worst of all, because I'm sure they're far from that. You know what I mean? I think it's really important to say that, because I don't want this to be like, you know, a witch hunt on Japan, because that's not fair at all.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, I just came across this statistic this morning. I believe there are something like 40 solitary elephants across Europe. So, you know, it is a world issue, but as long as it's kind of one of those things where you need to start somewhere.
Exactly.
And if you don't, then it just becomes an ignored issue, you know, in places everywhere. So that's really my goal. Is it's funny enough, it has nothing to necessarily do with Japan. I think if I'd come across the same situation in Canada, I would have tried to
do
the same thing.
Cool.
Yeah. So.
Cool. Well, I wanted to ask Dr. Keith Lindsay a couple questions about the elephants, if that's okay with you.
Sure thing.
Sure.
And so, Dr. Lindsay, I have a lot of elephant questions. I know nothing about these animals. Are there many different breeds or many different kinds?
Yeah, well, first thing I'd say is a bit about me. I studied elephants in Africa starting in the mid-70s, late 70s. So my experience is mostly with African elephants, but I also know a bit about Asian elephants. And yeah, there are two main species groups of elephants. There's African elephants, and there's two species of them that recently been decided that the bush elephants are the ones that we, you know, see in the pictures of the savannas. But also there is forest elephants in the Congo Basin.
Huh.
And it's been decided recently that they're actually different enough genetically and everything else to be different species. The forest ones are smaller, and they have other things that are different.
That's wild.
And then there are Asian elephants. Mm-hmm. Asian elephants are a single species spread across the whole of Asia from Sri Lanka through the mainland down to Southeast Asia.
Okay.
It's one species, but there's possibly three subspecies within that.
Wow. So
yeah.
When I was...
There's two main species, yeah.
I'm shocked that there are this many. So, for example, when I was in India, I was probably seeing Asian elephants there.
Yes, Asian elephants are in Sri Lanka, India, Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Myanmar, down into Southeast Asia. And then, as I said, they think there might be different subspecies, so maybe different ones on Sri Lanka, slightly different from the Indian ones, and then Borneo might have a subspecies.
Oh, wow.
But they're all pretty similar. Yeah, they're all pretty similar.
And so the elephants that you guys are dealing with in Japan, are they all Asian elephants, or is it like a selection?
In Japan, they've got, as Yulara said, they said something like 100 elephants. I think something like two-thirds or three-quarters are Asian elephants,
mm-hmm.
Mostly from nearby countries. And then they do have African elephants as well, a smaller number.
And so what is the typical lifespan of an elephant?
Well, elephants in the wild, there's lifespan's a funny thing. It's what's the maximum and then what's the average? And the maximum is around 60 or 70 years.
Okay.
Similar to the human lifespan. And interestingly, they also come sort of sexually mature around 10 or 12.
Just oh, wow.
And that's similar for the African and Asian elephants. Asian elephants might live a bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
But then the average, because they have infant mortality and droughts and such things, in the wild, the studies that have been done and the one that I was involved with in southern Kenya, Amboseli, found the sort of average age expectancy from birth, life expectancy, was around 40-some years.
Okay.
That's the sort of average. Probably similar in Asian elephants. But in zoos, it's much different. There are really species that don't do well in zoos. And so in zoos, average life expectancy for Asian elephants is in the 20s or so.
Ugh.
So, and for African elephants, it's in the teens or early, late teens. And that's because there's a lot of infant mortality.
Wow.
Or juvenile mortality. And they get diseases and health conditions in zoos that you don't ever see in the wild.
Oh, God, that must be so frustrating.
Yeah, it is. It's very, it's very sad for me.
Yeah.
Coming from an experience of working with wild elephants, to see the conditions that they have to live in zoos, it's very sad, really.
Yeah, and... I mean, one of the things that was one of the first questions that crossed my mind when you guys first reached out and hearing about these elephants in solitary, what is this, like, for example, when you were in Africa, what's the typical social structure of elephants?
Again, there's the differences between the Asian elephants and the African, and also, interestingly, between the forest elephants and the bush elephants.
Huh.
But the main unit for both all species of elephants is the mother and their offspring. The females and their young stay mm-hmm. together for much of their lives. But then the males will leave the kind of maternal group
mm-hmm.
Around 10 to 15 years old when they can become sexually mature. In African elephants, the females stay together, and so you might have sisters,
mm-hmm.
Mothers, daughters, granddaughters, and those are staying together in a fairly cohesive group. So you get a bit what they call a family unit, and they're all they travel around together with their family,
yeah.
and
In forest elephants, the groups are smaller. It's still mother offspring, but they don't travel together so much. They might be in contact. You know, kind of they can hear their rumbles over miles away.
Wow.
And in the Asian elephants, the studies suggest it's slightly different. They're less cohesive, the groups, but they still form these groups, and they seem to form friendships just as much as they spend time with their relatives.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting differences, but similarities as well.
So in one sense, I mean, it's a different social structure. However, it's similar to humans in the fact that they need interaction of their own species, and they're better if they're in a bunch than if it's like a hermit elephant that's, you know, nowhere. So I'm assuming being solitary is going to increase stresses and increase, you know, social capability and all this kind of thing, because if they're used to, for example, I'm a very, very social person. I talk to people every day. I see people every day. If I was to be thrown on a desert island solo, I don't know how long I'd last, to be totally honest with you, even if I had all the comforts of home, you know? So that bonding and that interaction is so, so important that it just breaks my heart to hear this.
Yeah, it's really important to elephants. I mean, the fact that they stay with their kin most of their lives means that they know each other very well, and also they get a chance to take care of young females. Get a chance to take care of calves before they have their own. They take care of, you know, their mothers or their sisters. You know, these sort of, so they get a chance. So they learn a lot. They learn what to eat and everything else. The social learning is very important with elephants.
Mm.
And if they brought up by themselves, and you know, stuck alone in their heads. They do, yeah, they suffer at the time, and they suffer in the longer term, because then if they ever have a calf, they don't know what to do with it.
Makes sense.
So it's sort of, it's terrible. I mean, they're very social, very intelligent animals as well. And part of the reason it seems that they're intelligent is because they live in social groups, you know, and you need a kind of social intelligence, all the monkeys and apes that, and dolphins and other social creatures like that use that intelligence.
It's really amazing. But we need to take a break for station identification. So we're going to stay on hold. We'll be about a minute and a half, and we'll be back to continue this conversation all about elephants in Japan. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
I am talking to Yulora Nagakawa and Dr. Keith Lindsay all about elephants in Japan, and they are working to save the elephants that are living in solitary. So, Dr. Lindsay, we were talking about how smart an elephant is. How smart are they?
Well, how long is a piece of string? one could say that they are they're certainly among the more intelligent animals. Up there with apes, great apes, and dolphins and cetaceans, in terms of the intelligence, and research on their brain structure has found similar brain cells to the higher functioning other mammals. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, because I mean, I could be totally wrong, so please correct me if I am. But I'm under the understanding that, like, if someone in their group dies, they actually mourn and things like this. Like, they seem to be able to reason, and they seem to be able to kind of, you know, if A equals B and B equals C, then this kind of thing. Like, they seem like they like really know what's going on at all times.
Oh yeah, I mean, they have a really amazing memory. There's this kind of truism about an elephant never forgets is actually true. I mean, they have a very big memory capacity for places, space. You know, they cover huge areas, thousands of square miles in some cases, and they know where to find food at different times of year. Mm-hmm. And the older animals know that more than the younger animals, so they learn, and there's leadership.
Wow.
But also they really know other individual elephants, and they've done playback experiments where they played the voices of different elephants. And the target animal can identify whether that's a family member or an acquaintance or a stranger. Over 200 different animals.
Holy cow!
They know individually. Oh, yeah. And then they use that memory to find food, as they say, but also to work their social strategies to do the best for their offspring.
Wow. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, this is something I've always loved elephants, and I've always been a big fan, and I've read up on them a little bit, but it's like, I just, you know, they're so big and they're hard to find except in zoos that it's a tough thing to actually experience, you know, to even see them in the wild. I'm really jealous that you spent all this time with them. That's amazing.
Well, I was very lucky to, and my life took me there, but, you know, since it was a, you know, life-changing experience to be in the presence of these elephants and then just start to understand and see how they live, and the fact that such a huge animal can be so in control of its body. They are incredibly graceful and very gentle with each other as well. Calm. Admirable animals.
They just seem to be, I don't know if elegant is the right word, but they seem to have like this energy about them that is just so, they're so dignified. You know what I mean? I kind of feel like they should be in, like, wearing a tie. They almost have a little suit on.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, dignity is definitely a good way to describe them. And that's why it's so, you know, upsetting to see them taken out of their ecosystem, out of their woodland or their forest and stuck in a barren enclosure. Even one that's, that the problem really is the fact that they cannot, it's very hard for zoos to accommodate elephants.
Mm-hmm. And is that just because of, like, how the distances they cover, or?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at an elephant, they've got long legs, and their scale is just big.
Yeah.
And that's no accident. They're designed, because they're big, they need lots of food, and they have to cover large areas to find it, and they evolved that size and the brain to be able to cover large areas and find the food. And they spend three quarters of their three quarters of the whole day they spend feeding.
Wow.
Looking for food.
Wow.
So their minds are in the wild, their minds are active all the time,
mm-hmm.
looking for food and interacting with the other elephants. So to take them out of a complex environment, physically and socially, and stick them in a barren one is cruelty. It's not education.
God, they must be bored out of their minds.
Yeah, yeah, you can see that. And this is a thing that I saw particularly with the solitary elephants.
Mm-hmm.
But you see it also with elephants that are in company in zoos. But particularly the solitary ones don't even have the stimulation of another elephant. They look unhealthy because they stand in one spot and sway back and forth,
mm-hmm.
side to side or up and down, sway their heads, and you never see that in a wild elephant.
So that's a boredom coping mechanism, basically.
It's a very good term, yeah, coping mechanism for the
Yeah, the boredom, and sometimes it indicates that they're getting a bit excited because a lot of the zoos they seem, because of their, I don't know, their constraints on staffing and timetabling, is they will dump a bunch of food with the elephant and then leave it for three or four hours and
yeah.
eat it again.
Yeah.
And that's completely unlike the way an elephant would live. So, and there are good zoos that recognize this, and some of them will have a system for feeding the elephant small amounts throughout the day.
Nice.
And those elephants are a lot happier.
It's really wild. You know, it always fascinates me when it's this thing of like humans and we're like, yeah, you know, we're the best because we do math and we can read and we have computers. So we're smarter than everybody else, every animal, every organism out there. And it's like, once you start studying these things, I mean, I've been doing this show for a couple of years now and it's like intelligence. I think there are different levels of intelligence, but I think that we don't give animals nearly as much credit as we should regarding intelligence. And it's obviously they're not going to read and do what humans do, but their intelligence is to survive their day and to survive their life, as is ours. But, you know, I think they're just so much smarter than people think they are.
Yes. Smarter, but in a different way as well. So
yeah.
That is a very good point you make, is to try to look at their lives from their perspective rather than from what we project onto them. And I think this is a problem with the concept of keeping elephants in zoos that a lot of the organizations have. A very small number are better than that. But most of them regard them as a place for us to see the elephants.
Totally.
And a lot of the zoos in North America, less so now, but historically, and still in Japan, some of the ones we saw were associated with an amusement park.
Ugh,
so there'd be rides and things for kids to do, and then they can go and look at the animals, and they just see the animals sitting in cages. And some zoos nowadays are starting to try to give the animals what they need from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start doing that and taking it seriously, you realize that you're not really capable of doing that with some animals. Some animals, it's okay. You know, some either small, very small animals, invertebrates, you know, frogs, lizards you could keep. but if you get these increasingly large animals that people seem to want to see in a zoo and ooh and ah for a few minutes, really to give them what they need, you need to have very large areas.
Makes sense.
And that's simply not possible.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I lived in Florida in the 90s, and there was this traveling carnival/circus thing that kind of came through, you know, and it would camp down. It would come every couple of years, and it would camp down in this weird vacant lot, and they had elephants. And I don't know how many they had. I think they had two or three. And, you know, the whole cruel living of the chain around the leg and all of this. And, well, one day, I don't know what happened, but one of the elephants just flipped out and went on this rampage. And it was bad. It was really bad. A lot of people got hurt. A lot of the circus tent was damaged. I mean, it was just this poor thing just flipped out and just started running. And it was really interesting to hear the responses from people because it was like, oh, you know, he's an evil elephant. And it was all, everyone's trying to rationalize this is like, oh, well, he just hates people and he just wanted to wreck our day kind of thing. And it's like, no, this poor animal has just flipped out because it's not being able to be what it is, you know? And so I was a big defender of the elephant. Yeah, Eulara, please.
Now, Celia, when you say that, it's so interesting because one of the things that many people are quite surprised by with elephants that we've learned through the campaign is that they're wild animals. If you look at, you know, a cow or a horse or a cat or a dog, they've all been domesticated. So, you know, with an elephant, it is a wild animal, and it's inherently still wild. So it would be like equivalent of taking a human and not allowing it to speak.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or interact with other humans, or just taking away, stripping its very essential nature of being. And I think that's something that people really need to understand.
I think that's a great point, too, because I think thanks to the Jungle Book and everything else, everyone's got these fantasies of like, oh, look, an elephant. I'm just going to climb up on it, and we're going to be friends, and we're going to go for a ride. And it's like, no, this is a wild animal, and he could kill you in about 3 seconds. You know, like, I think that elephants have kind of lost that respect that, like, lions and tigers have, and, you know, cheetahs, and, like, all these wild cats, because they've got the claws, and they've got the teeth, and they're really fast. And I think people are like, oh, look, it's Dumbo. It's like, no. You know, it's like, this thing can get you too. So I appreciate you saying that, because it's a really, really important fact, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And then there's, on top of that, you've got this tourist and selfie culture where people are wanting to capture these moments. And sorry, Dr. Lindsay, go ahead. You were going to say something there.
We're talking at cross purposes. No, I was just going to say that I saw a piece recently that was talking about, it was actually about children's literature, but it mentioned the messages, and it was about a different study entirely about children learning compassion from the books they read, and there are books with animal characters in them, and one of the throwaway lines in the article was that of books that have animal characters in them, only 2% show animals behaving like animals, and 98% of the children's books are animals behaving like people. So it's no surprise that we come to a feeling for, if when you take children to the zoo, they're taking their children book impression of the animals to that zoo with them. And that's the zoos don't do enough to try to make that difference. This is the one thing that I did feel in Japan, and I've seen it obviously in Canada, the U.S. and in England here, is that the people who go to zoos are often taking kids with them to show them the animals.
Totally.
And it's just an entertainment thing, and not an educational thing. People say, "Oh, we need zoos for educating about nature," but you don't really get a feel of nature. You see the animals, sure, but you don't see them in their social group, in their environment. Feeding all these things, and this is the concern that we bring out in the report. And by the way, a copy of the report can be downloaded from the URL, the website, elephantsinjapan.com.
Cool.
So people can go and see information about the elephants and what you can do for the elephants. Those elephants.
Nice.
And also read the report.
Yeah, because I was just at the Bronx Zoo probably about a month ago, and I haven't been in years. And I mean, I grew up at that zoo, and fortunately, my father was very, very into animals, but more about the animal themselves. So, like, we weren't going, like, yay, let's look at everything, you know, but we went on a couple of these, like, they have I think it's a Southeast Asia ride or something where, you know, the people are in the cages and the animals are loose, which I'm all for. I think it's great. But it was really interesting to hear the responses of the people, because they give them enough roaming area, so if they don't want to be stared at all day by humans, they can get away and be in a decent spot. They don't have to, like, hide underneath the monorail or things like that. And there were a fair amount of animals kind of, like, you know, in mud holes, and just, it was hot. And so they were trying to find shade and cool wherever they could. And, I mean, these people were so pissed. And they're like, well, I paid to see the cheetah. The cheetah's not even there. And, oh, my God, I just saw a buffalo's foot. And it was really interesting to hear this, because it was like, you guys have no empathy. Like, it's 100 degrees. It's boiling hot in the sun. Where you're seeing is direct sunlight. Like, I wouldn't be there either, would you? Come on, you know? And to see people, like, they'd run up to an exhibit, they'd look at it for about, I don't know, less than 30 seconds, and then just take off to see the next thing. So there's this real disconnect there of, you know, like, no, this is a living being, sentient, you know, creature. And obviously, you know, we don't love all the same animals, and some people flip out in the snake house, things like that. But, you know, usually you'll find that someone will find something and they'll really resonate with them and stick around with them. And the only area that I saw where people actually really hung out was with the sea lions. That was it.
Yeah.
The monkeys smell too much. We don't like the monkeys because they stink. And it's like, well, yeah, they stink. They're wild animals. They're monkeys. This is how a monkey smells. We smell terrible to them, you know? So it's really interesting to see. I almost feel like there's a broader disconnect than when I was younger regarding these animals. and being used solely as a method of entertainment and not given the respect of being this creature that lives with us. And so this is why, this is actually what the reason I contacted. When you guys reached out to us, I was like, I need to talk to you guys because I think that this topic is really, really important right now on very many different levels.
Well, this is why more and more people, you know, need to start beginning to get involved, speaking out.
Yeah.
You know, really just being more focused on the cause. And one of the things is that I do sense a shift.
Good.
When you talk about zoos or captive animals with people, a lot of people react with like sad eyes.
Good.
They go, oh. So I think the time is ripe. And I think people are interested. It's just a matter of getting the right information across. There's so much misinformation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as Keith mentioned, he's written this 115-page report, which goes into detail about every one of the 14 solitary elephants that we examined.
Wow.
And for instance, you know, there are some cases that are worse than others, and I don't want to reduce the 14 elephants to subjects and numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, we're really focused right now on an elephant named Miyako,
mm-hmm.
who was taken away from her family in Thailand when she was 6 months old.
Oh, God, no.
So just a baby. And she was brought to the zoo where she has lived completely alone in a featureless environment for 44 years.
Oh, my God.
And counting. And, she, you know, all she's gotten there is a steel bar, which she bites on out of stress.
Oh, my God.
And all day long. And then she has no interaction with any keepers or other animals because they've deemed that she's too dangerous. So, you know, they have names, they have stories,
yeah.
and this is real. And I think the more people educate themselves
mm-hmm.
on what the elephant's perspective is and that they are a wild animal and, you know, begin to change things for is the better for the animals involved. But I do think the time is ripe. Like, I think there's a bit of a change thanks to, you know, the proliferation of
Good.
Digital technologies like social media and so on. People are spreading the word.
Good.
So that's what we're really trying to do. So if people want to help, like Dr. Lindsay said, they can go to our website and there's a report there, which is the information is applicable to any other captive elephant.
Wow.
You can really learn about what's going on. You can see the elephants like Miyako and learn about their stories. And then we've also got a take action page.
Beautiful.
Where people can find out how they can really help. And so, you know, moving forward, we are going to need to raise funds
mm-hmm.
to conduct all sorts of activities to help the elephants, including things like, you know, sending someone like Dr. Lindsay over to the zoos,
yeah.
to work with the zoos, just to teach them a little bit more about elephant welfare and, you know, get them to make some immediate improvements
mm-hmm.
to their lives because, you know, getting an elephant moved to a sanctuary is a pretty big task.
God, and I can't even
we'd love
imagine.
To see them all, you know, sent to sanctuary tomorrow, but
yeah.
we're going to have to take incremental steps. But the fact is, these elephants, day by day, they're alone, they have nothing to do, and they suffer. So if people can pitch in, that would be amazing. We have so much. We've got 14 elephants. We've got tons of, you know, initiatives that
yeah.
that need to be carried out sooner than later. So they'll be able to find that option on the take action page as well.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. However, I got two questions for you. And this is my last question for you is, well, my second to last question for you. It's something that I'm just really, really curious about because like, I am so grateful for what you guys are doing. And I'm so relieved that you're trying to help all these elephants in need. However, this has got to be really, really difficult and taxing work for you guys. So like, how do you stay sane?
Well, I mean, I can start and I will tell you that I'm not going to lie. I mean, the first time I found this out, I just cried.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we've got an elephant. There's one named Sunny who you can go on the website and see the footage of her. But she's kept the majority of her days in the wintertime in this tiny enclosure.
Mm.
It would be the equivalent of you in a bathroom.
Nice.
A small bathroom.
Nice.
And she's kept in there sometimes up to 24 hours a day. With
oh,
no, and it is the most barren cell. It would be like nothing. It's featureless.
Oh.
And what she does is because she's in there and she, as we talked about, she's so intelligent and social.
Yeah.
She explores the walls of her cell with her trunk.
Oh, this poor thing.
And so if you see the footage, she's been in this enclosure for 28 years
oh
alone.
Oh my God.
So you can see all these marks that she's made with her trunk
from
the hours and hours and days and days and years that she's desperately been trying to find something to do.
Oh, my God.
You know? And so you can imagine what that feels like because you're seeing this for the first time and you're just like, you want the world to know. You want to cry out. But it's about being, you know, I suppose you just have to be slow and steady.
Yeah.
And take a step back, have your cry out, you know.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, now it's time to act. And so that's where the campaign comes in. And I can tell you one thing, if you're a fledgling animal advocate.
Yeah, please.
Do something. Do something.
No kidding,
like,
right?
Go to a coffee shop and sign 1,000 petitions if you have to.
Yeah.
You know, that. Trust me, I feel the pain. I was born to feel the pain of animals. And the one thing that helps me is to actually do something.
That's awesome.
Whatever it is.
I hear you.
And so that's me. And I'll let Dr. Lindsay, I know it was hard for him because he had to actually go on the ground. So I'd love to hear, you know.
Yeah, Dr. Lindsay, how do you keep yourself okay with all this?
Well, I share the same kind of feelings of pain when I see these elephants in these kind of conditions. I guess the thing that I feel is that, with you, Laura, there is a growing sense among the populace of many different countries, and it's, you know, it's taken years and years in North America for people to wake up to the problems of elephants. But you know, and still there are circuses, as you talked about, the traveling shows. But recently, state after city, originally cities and then states, have been passing legislation in the U.S. to ban the use of the bullhook for controlling elephants, and that means that the circuses can't control the elephants the way they used to. So Ringling decided initially to stop. They could see the writing on the wall that Los Angeles wouldn't allow them. So that was a kind of a snowball. And now Ringling has closed the circus entirely.
Are you serious? So, you know, I didn't even hear about that.
Yeah, last year.
Last year they announced that not only were they closing down, stopping traveling elephants, but they decided, you know what, we're just going to stop the traveling shows entirely.
Oh, my God.
The wild animals.
I didn't hear that part. Yeah, that's so fantastic.
They have to find homes for those animals, but the fact is that is a change that's happened in the last few years.
That's unbelievable.
And increasingly you hear people, as Yulara said, talking about when they go to the zoo, you know, that they're seeing it, you know, with different eyes. You know, you see all these films on television and in the cinema of animals, you know, amazing animals doing amazing things.
Yeah.
And then you go to the zoo, and some people say, oh, there's no substitute for seeing them in, you know, right in front of you there.
Yeah.
But when you go to see them in the zoo, they're so different from the ones you see in the nature films. And people are starting to realize that.
Oh, thank God.
And that encourages me. And even in, you know, when I was going to say even in Japan.
Yeah.
But it's not even in Japan. Some of the zoos in Japan are actually quite good.
Good.
So in the report, we talk about how it just sort of happened this way. That I went to 14 zoos in 14 days, which was another story.
Wow!
And Yulara did an amazing job of organizing that itinerary. But there were three different types. They fell into three different groups, and some were these really terrible old zoos, with the amusement park and the tiny enclosures. But there were some in the middle that were kind of halfway. What we recognize as modern, and then there were some that were, you know, pretty much up to North American zoo standards
Good.
In Japan.
Good.
So there are people there, and particularly encouraging was that some of the primate exhibits were very good for the primates.
Oh, thank
much
God.
Happier. So it seemed like some of the people in the universities there are working with the zoo people.
Yay!
So we want to encourage that, and we see that there's a space to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's encouraging.
Oh, that's such good news to hear.
And if I can just add one tiny thing to that,
please,
the other thing is a lot of zoos now are starting, well, I'm not going to say a lot, a handful of zoos globally, including a few in Japan, are now closing their elephant exhibits once
awesome.
The elephant passes or if they get moved to another facility, another
good.
Zoo. So this is another you know, thing that is very hopeful is that if people, the visitors of the zoos, can change things and flip it and just say, why do you have an elephant here?
Yeah.
You know, that could create some demand for zoos to
totally.
Realize that this is not what is going to be the biggest draw for people, because
oh
it is cruel and it's just unethical, you know?
I am so glad to talk to you guys. This whole interview started off really depressing, but now, like, hearing that you guys are doing things and things are being accomplished for these elephants, I feel so much better. So thank you so much for what you guys are doing. I want to make sure that we tell us all your social media links, because my listeners love to follow things like this, and if they're going to want to find out more, so let's make it easy for them.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about it as well. By you know, doing this, it's bringing even more people into the fold to see, you know, what the plight is. So we're so grateful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, it's been, I mean, for me, this is the only way that I can help out animals, because, like, I can't even handle the ASPCA commercials, you know, with the singing and the dog that's been beaten. And like, I can't. I, like, start crying. And, like, when I first found out about you guys and started researching you, I mean, I was in tears. And so I'm so grateful that, like, you guys are accomplishing things and you're making their lives better for these animals, which, you know, it may seem like a little thing to someone who doesn't really know much, but this is, it's, you know, everything's connected and this is really, really important. So where can my people find you on, where you guys are, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and your website?
Yep. So www.elephantsinjapan.com is the website. And then we've got a Facebook page. You can just search for Elephants in Japan, and it'll come up as a page with a logo of a red elephant on white background. And similarly on Twitter, if you look up Elephants in Japan, you can find us there.
Perfect.
And follow the efforts. And hopefully something good will come soon, sooner than later.
I'm behind you guys 1,000%. I would love for you all to keep in touch. I want to hear from you guys in like a year. Let's touch base and see how everything's going, because I think what you're doing is really, really, really important. And, you know, from all the elephants and from me, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right back at you.
Oh, my God. It's been great. And so, Dr. Lindsay, thank you so much for staying up super late and talking to us.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. It's really sweet. And you, Laura, you're adorable and you're so motivated. And I think you're fantastic. And I wait to say, and it's Yulara Nakagawa, okay? Because I messed that up twice. So I apologize. I'm usually really good at Japanese names, but I was nervous. I haven't been here in a couple weeks. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Have a good rest of your day.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. And for all the listeners out there, I will be back next week with a new episode. You know where to find me. Twitter, I'm at Food Healer. Instagram, I'm Animal Instinct Radio. And Facebook, Animal Instinct. When you're doing the search, put 73 at the end or you won't find me. Look for the cat wearing glasses. Thanks, guys. I'll see you next week. Until then, take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy.
They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.